John Bachman, who pierces people's face. The K is for the kill, L is for the lover, and the M is for the mutiny, and I wish it didn't happen.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg. Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, where's my drum?
Now the N is for knots, oh no, my bones are sinking. The B is for the peg leg that keeps me standing up. A Q is for quantum leap, R is for the rum, and the S is for the scurvy, which I wish I didn't get.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg.
That's underneath my boat. And B is for Mukitas, who plays a sour note. W is Tiasis, X marks a spot. Why? Cause I'm a pirate.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg. Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, where's my grog?
This is WSQT Direct Action Radio, broadcasting on 90.5 FM from Washington, D.C. If you can hear this signal and you like what you hear, send an email to WSQTRadio@hushmail.com. Repeat, WSQTRadio@hushmail.com.
Welcome to Palestine Today, service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org, for December 10th to the 16th, 2011. Conditional resumption of U.S. funding to the Palestinian Authority. Meanwhile, settler violence increases, especially targeting mosques. These stories and more are coming up. Stay tuned. Let's begin our weekly report with the non-violent activities in the West Bank. I am EMC's Doris Norito with a story.
Dozens of people in the village of Belayin, west of Ramallah, suffered the effects of poison gas in the weekly march organized by the Popular Committee Against the Wall and Settlements. International and Israeli peace activists joined Palestinians to act in solidarity with the villagers of Nabi Salah. The march began after Friday prayers from the center of Belayin village. Marchers headed for the land that had been liberated 6 months ago. Participants raised Palestinian flags and displayed pictures of Shahid Mustafa al-Hamimi, who was killed last Friday by a gas canister during the demonstration in his village of Nabi Salah. The demonstrating participants chanted national slogans calling for the end of occupation and for the tearing down of the apartheid wall. They called on Palestinians to remain faithful to the objective goals of the Palestinian people and called for the freedom of all Palestinian prisoners. In the Abu Lemon area, participants removed part of a barbed wire barrier when they first arrived. Soldiers stationed behind the concrete wall responded by shooting stun grenades and tear gas at the participants. Dozens of protesters succumbed to injuries, asphyxia, and suffocation as a result. They were treated in the field by ambulance crews. Some protesters threw stones at the soldiers situated behind the wall. The Israeli occupation army chased the participants into olive groves and beyond to the outskirts of the village in an attempt to arrest them. None were arrested, and the soldiers eventually retreated. In the nearby village of Nabi Salah, Israeli forces detained at least 15 people during a protest in the village on Friday. Demonstrators clashed with soldiers at the march to commemorate Mustafa Tamimi, a 28-year-old villager killed by a tear gas canister fired by Israeli soldiers a week earlier. The mother of Tamimi led in the front line of the procession of marchers, witnesses said. Witnesses also said that forces fired tear gas at the protesters. Internationals were detained at the entrance of Halamish settlement bordering Nabi Saleh. The Ramallah district village hosts weekly protests against land confiscation for the illegal settlement. Israel has cracked down on the village residents by carrying out night raids and arresting accused stone throwers. An Israeli army spokesman said 15 people, including Palestinians, Israelis, and internationals, were detained at the entrance of Halamish settlement bordering Nabi Saleh. For IMEMC News, this is Doris Norito.
Iceland recognizes the Palestinian state, and the U.S. Congress will resume funding to the Palestinian Authority for next year. The details with IMEMC's Carmen Rodriguez.
On Friday, the U.S. Congress proposed to continue the American financial support to the Palestinian Authority next year as long as it refrains from filing any other membership applications to the United Nations agencies. The proposal that was released on Thursday also states that the Palestinian representative office in Washington, D.C. will remain open as long as Palestine is not accepted as a member in UN institutions. Meanwhile, Palestinian Prime Minister Salam Fayyad stated that raising the Palestinian flag at the UNESCO headquarters is an important step. He claimed that this will be followed by other similar steps until the Palestinian flag is raised on all mosques and churches in Jerusalem and in countries around the world. On Thursday, Iceland recognized Palestine as a state. During a special ceremony at its capital, Reykjavik, Iceland's foreign minister officially informed that his country officially recognized Palestine as a state within the 1967 borders, with East Jerusalem as its capital. Meanwhile, with regards to the week's settlers' attacks, Israeli Defense Minister Ehud Barak told the Army Radio that he considered the recent attacks to be the work of Jewish terrorists. On Saturday, it was published that the United Nations General Assembly passed 9 resolutions related to Palestine as part of a set of 24 resolutions and 2 tests related to human rights and decolonization. Also on Saturday, Palestinian Prime Minister Salam Fayyad stated that the statements of U.S. Republican president candidate Newt Gingrich are cheap and disgraceful. Gingrich stated on Friday that the Palestinians are an invented people. For IMEMC News, this is Carmen Rodriguez.
This week has seen an increase in violence from Israeli settlers and the army, with 2 mosques being torched and military base being attacked, and 21 Palestinian civilians, including 8 children, being wounded. 5 were killed in Gaza, 2 fighters and a man and his child, and a protester was killed in the West Bank. IMEMC's William Gibson with the details.
Last Friday afternoon, Mustafa Tamimi, a 28-year-old Palestinian activist from the village of Nabi Saleh, near the northern West Bank city of Ramallah, was critically injured after an Israeli soldier fired a tear gas canister into his face. Tamimi died the next day and becomes the first person to die in the weekly protests at the village. In an official statement, the army have claimed that the soldier did not see Mustafa when he fired, and the military official tweeted, implied that the action was justified because he had a slingshot in his pocket when he was hit. On Monday, extremist right-wing settlers broke into a closed military zone between the West Bank and the Jordanian border. Their protest regarded King Abdullah of Jordan interfering in Israeli affairs. The Israeli army encircled the settlers and prevented them from invading Jordanian territory, with the incident occurring at the Jordan River on the site believed to be where John the Baptist baptized Jesus. More settlers attacked an Israeli military base near Qalqilya, whereby 50 settlers broke in and set fires to the barracks and damaged vehicles. Other settlers attacked military jeeps and injured the brigade commander along the main road near the settlement of Ramat Gilad. The same settlers also threw stones at Palestinian cars. On Tuesday night, a small group of settlers attempted to burn down a mosque in Jerusalem, After failing to gain entry, they tried to torch the external walls and spray-painted insulting graffiti. A second mosque was also attacked, this time in Burka village, just east of Ramallah. The arson attack damaged the ground floor and the first floor, with graffiti also being sprayed around the building. This is the third mosque to be attacked in the last 10 days, and the string of attacks comes as tension mounts over the impending dismantlement of numerous illegal settlements outposts within the West Bank. The settlers in question claim that the Israeli Defence Minister, Ehud Barak, is responsible for the escalation, and claim that Barak, quote, discriminates against the settlers and the settlements, unquote. On Wednesday evening, clashes occurred in Jerusalem after police attempted to arrest those suspected in several of the recent attacks. Dozens of settler youth arrived to prevent the police gaining access to the suspect apartment and clashed with the police, and several tyres were slashed. The police managed to raid the apartment and made 6 arrests. Several were injured over the week in Gaza, including 2, one of them a child, being injured on Tuesday after an army incursion near the Al-Burej refugee camp. A third person was shot in the thigh in a separate incident on Wednesday. 4 homes were demolished in Beit Jala near Bethlehem earlier on in this week. The residents in question had been barred from their lands due to its proximity to a nearby tunnel linking Jerusalem to a settlement. They claim they received no demolition notices or orders from the civil administration. Ayman Darakma has become the 24th elected Palestinian legislator to be put behind bars after the Israeli army arrested him from his home in Ramallah on Wednesday. Darakma, belonging to Hamas-run Change and Reform Bloc, was only released from a 20-month prison sentence a year ago. For IM EMC News, this is William Gibson.
And that was just some of the news from this week in Palestine. For more updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. We would like to inform you that IMEMC will not produce This Week in Palestine next week, and we will be back with you on December 30th. Thank you for joining us from Occupied Bethlehem. This report has been brought to you by Hassan Kassis and me, George Ishmael. Best wishes from the IMEMC News. Merry Christmas and Happy New Year.
On Thursday, the 15th of December, the United States formally ended the war in and occupation of Iraq, or at least its open involvement in it. At a fortified bunker at the Baghdad airport, the U.S. flag was lowered and boxed up in a casing the colors ceremony. Today, the U.S. turned over the last U.S. base in Iraq, Camp Adder, to the Iraqi government. Thousands of mercenaries will remain behind, supposedly to guard the U.S. embassy. Of course, the war is not over for the residents of Baghdad. Baghdad, Iraq. Yesterday, on the same day the war officially ended, a bombing in Baghdad gravely wounded a teacher and his son. Mosul, Iraq. Yesterday, on the same day the war officially ended, a bomb exploded against a police patrol in Mosul, wounding one man and one woman. Mosul, Iraq. Yesterday, an Iraqi soldier was shot dead by unknown armed men. The Iraq War began with George W. Bush freaking out about weapons of mass destruction and talk similar to what we now hear about nuclear weapons programs in Iran. No weapons of mass destruction were ever found. The Iraq War is ending with some claiming the failure of al-Qaeda in Iraq seize and hold state power means the U.S. has won. The only thing is, al-Qaeda in Iraq did not exist in January 2003, so their defeat cannot have been the original U.S. war goal. The U.S. has failed to transform Iraq into a free market laboratory, the way Paul Bremer and the Coalition Provisional Authority proposed to do until the insurgency started up in summer 2003. The current Middle Eastern democracy movements show little or no interest in that form of economics. Therefore, the U.S. was not successful in the war goal of creating a free market laboratory in the Middle East. The U.S. has failed to force the Iraqi parliament to pass a multinational friendly hydrocarbon or oil law so beloved of the Iraq Study Group, so the U.S. did not win an oil war in Iraq. Saddam Hussein may no longer be in power, but Iraq has been left a far more violent place. Just ask the teacher who was wounded by a bombing in Baghdad the day the U.S. cased the colors and formalized the so-called end of the war. The last American to die in Iraq, the 4,483rd and final combat fatality, was 23-year-old Specialist David Hickman. He was killed by a roadside bomb in Taji on the 14th of November. U.S. troops may be leaving, except for 157 exceptions and tens of thousands of mercenaries. Meanwhile, all the insurgent and sectarian movements are still very much alive, and the U.S. has graciously eliminated Iran's number one enemy in the region. War in Iraq over? I don't think so. Mission accomplished? That's been said before.
This is WSQT Direct Action Radio, broadcasting on 90.5 FM from Washington, D.C. If you can hear this signal and you like what you hear, send an email to WSQTRadio@hushmail.com. Repeat, WSQTRadio@hushmail.com.
Since Republican candidates scored major victories for state offices across the U.S. last November, state governments controlled by the GOP have passed numerous measures restricting the right of targeted constituencies to cast ballots. A recent report by the NAACP Legal Defense and Education Fund titled Defending Democracy, Confronting Modern Barriers to Voting Rights in America documents what the group asserts is a coordinated assault on minorities' voting rights who often heavily favor Democratic candidates. The report found that in more than a dozen states, measures have been signed into law during 2011 that impose new restrictions on the types of voter IDs required to cast a ballot, limiting the number of days for early voting, marginalizing student voters, creating unnecessary obstacles for groups registering new voters, as well as disenfranchising the disabled and ex-felons. The study concluded that if these restrictions were not reversed, more than 5 million Americans may be denied the right to vote, a fact that could dramatically change the outcome of state and federal election results, as well as the race for the White House. A coalition of more than 100 groups led by the NAACP came together in New York City for a protest at the United Nations on December 10th to launch a national campaign to challenge restrictions on voting rights. The march, that organizers say drew 20 to 25,000 participants, began at the headquarters of the billionaire Koch brothers, who provided $1 million in funding to the American Legislative Exchange Council, or ALEC, that designed many of the legislative templates to restrict voting rights. Your reporter spoke with April Tyler, an organizer with the December 10th Mobilization Committee, who talks about the ways in which the National Standing for Freedom campaign will work to reverse Republican Party measures to suppress voting rights.
Well, the bottom line message is, one, that we have got to be ever vigilant. And we remember, many of us who are African American and immigrants, activists from the 1950s, 1960s, we remember the Jim Crow laws, and we remember when, or, you know, I don't remember because I'm too young, but my parents and grandparents remember when there were poll taxes, there were literacy tests, when people really did not have the right to vote. And, you know, I've studied my civil rights history, so I know that there were lots of people who fought and who died for me to have the right to vote. And so the bottom line message was that we fought for this right. Many of us died for this right. Many of our brothers and sisters and even our family members died for us to have the right to vote. So we cannot sit still and let the rights be eroded. We also stood before the United Nations on UN Human Rights Day because we feel that this is not just a civil right, it's not just a constitutional right, it's a human right to be able to participate in the governance of your country. And we aim to not only beat back these efforts, but to broaden the voting rights for more people in this country.
April, tell us what's going on in states around the country that are controlled by Republican governors and legislatures regarding restrictions imposed on the right to vote, for example, imposing strict voter ID regulations, limiting early voting, marginalizing student voters, and throwing up obstacles on registering new voters. It's a long list of things in a long list of states, but if you could summarize some of the things that concern you most.
Okay, in almost 40 states across the country, there either has been laws passed in recent years, the last couple of years, or laws introduced to require specific voter identification, photo voter identification. And we see this as a problem because in order to obtain those specific types of identification, you have to either have particular documents or to prove your identity, or you've got to purchase those documents. So we see this as a backdoor poll tax. Additionally, we see a problem with the efforts to restrict student voting, requiring specific forms of student identification. And specifically in Texas, if you have a gun license issued by the National Rifle Association, you can vote. But if you got a student identification card issued from the University of Texas, you may not be able to vote. Additionally, in specific states, particularly across the South, where on Sundays, the last Sunday before Election Day, they would organize what they call souls to the polls. And after service, people would go together and vote. And they've now eliminated that in at least two states and have it pending in a few other states. So those, as well as a few other issues, we see is very problematic. And we see it as targeted toward students, elderly, disabled, minorities, immigrants, who would be, you know, we're the 99%. We're not going to vote for eliminating the millionaire's tax. And we're going to vote for more progressive issues. And the effort, which is funded in large part by, you know, the Koch brothers and conservative organizations, is targeted at restricting our access.
How is your coalition addressing a remedy here? I guess there's a couple of avenues you could take, going through the courts, the U.S. Justice Department pursuing violations of the United States Civil Rights Act. You could also take the direct action route, realizing that voting rights are an essential element to democracy. And we certainly have many examples in U.S. history where direct action was taken to preserve the right to vote. Where are you targeting your efforts right now?
All of the above. There are legal efforts in each state where these laws have passed or are being proposed. There's actually conversations with the U.S. Justice Department about pushing back and being ever vigilant when the districts that have to be pre-approved by the Justice Department come before them. And we are also doing direct action across the nation. December 10th was just the kickoff. You know, with the NAACP and the coalition that was formed and that is still growing, we plan to, you know, keep this on the front burner throughout, you know, the next couple of years at least.
That was April Tyler, an organizer with a December 10th mobilization committee. Find links to more information on the campaign to overturn restrictions on voting rights at our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org.
Quite a security presence outside this Mitt Romney fundraiser, offering campaign cash levels ranging from $100 a plate to $10,000 a plate, and one level in between. Occupy DC's out here. It was stupid to have a Mitt Romney fundraiser just 3 blocks from Occupy DC's campsite.
Planned Parenthood showed up too.
This fundraiser is so bad they couldn't even get Mitt Romney to come to the fundraiser. He didn't even show up, eh?
He shows up at $10,000.
It's $10,000, $5,000, and $100. So they got a $10,000 VIP level, a $5,000 level, and a $100 basic level.
$100 basic
level. Three-level dinner. $100 million worth of stocks.
So with Romney, goes to war in Iran.
Goes to war in Iran.
To blow up more children.
To blow up more children.
He'll probably be making money.
He'll probably be making money.
Mitt Romney brings more nuclear power.
Brings more nuclear power.
To permanently poison our planet.
To permanently poison our planet.
The environmental regulations. That protect us.
That protect us.
Our children.
And our planet.
And our planet. All of its stocks will go up.
All of its stocks will go up.
On the 15th of December, Occupy DC and Catholics United delivered a golden bull, symbolizing both a Wall Street bull and the biblical golden calf symbolizing idol worship to Capitol Hill, with the intention of delivering the bull to House Speaker Boehner. But the Capitol Police refused to allow the golden bull to enter the Longworth Building or any of the other Capitol Hill buildings.
Today,
why are we here today?
Because the worship of money.
Because the worship of money.
And profit.
And profit.
Is a spiritual sickness.
Is a spiritual sickness.
Unable to deliver the golden bull to House Speaker Boehner, Occupy DC and Catholics United parked the bull next to a church on Capitol Hill and continued to Boehner's office without it.
We bow our heads to give you thanks. I'd like today to particularly call out Speaker of the House, John Boehner, fellow Catholic, person of faith. We ask that you touch Speaker Boehner's heart as he leads this Congress in unprecedented cuts to the poor and vulnerable, that you touch his heart and remind him that as a person of God, he should be willing to ask those with the most ability to share the sacrifice being asked by all the American people. For us, that means making the Wall Street industry, the financial industry, who live in such luxury, to share some of that privilege with their fellow Americans.
I just can't think of a better symbol of Wall Street's greed and worship of money than a golden calf, or in this case, a golden bull, like the one that Occupy DC and Catholics United tried to deliver to Boehner's office. On the 15th of December, Occupy DC marched on a U.S. Chamber of Commerce Christmas party for the GOP, held just two blocks away from Occupy DC's own camp. Occupy was there to sing Occupy-themed Christmas carols such as this one.
This is how you give guys an open hand.
All those suit and tie wearing Republicans had to run a double line gauntlet of Occupy protesters to get to the door of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. Oh! That seems to be the opinion of a lot of Americans these days about bankers and the lobbyists and members of Congress they buy. Today, the 16th of December, D.C. voting rights activists and hunger strikers associated with Occupy D.C. again protested in front of the Longworth House office building. Hunger striker Adrian Parsons, now in a wheelchair, was arrested this morning, and there are fears that he might face force feeding. Force feeding in Guantanamo Bay has been done with nasogastric tubes, feeding tubes inserted through the nose that lawyers for detainees said caused extreme pain and suffering. DC Vote Communications Director James Jones was also arrested, and the Capitol Police closed off Independence Avenue in front of the Longworth Building during the arrest. The hunger strikers, who haven't eaten anything in over a week, have vowed to continue until either D.C. gets voting rights or they starve, whichever comes first. This song goes out to all you goons at Homeland Security, the U.S. Conference of Mayors, and police organizations that are trying to attack Occupy camps all across the U.S. Rich takes it for his children and rags welfare reform. Let them eat cake. Why should we care? Bye, 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 bye. See the greed of the shopping malls as they pick your pockets clean. Fat in the bottom line. Fat in your belly too. See the greed of the shopping malls as they pick your pockets clean. Fat in the bottom line. Fat in your belly too. Bye, 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 bye. Rich takes it for his children and rags welfare reform. Let them eat cake. Why should we care? Bye, 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 bye. See the greed of the shopping malls as they pick your pockets clean. Fat in the bottom line. Fat in your belly too.
As 2011 comes to a close, the year has seen the United States set a record for billion-dollar extreme weather disasters. Major storms, deaths, and record property damage occurred across the country, from a heat wave in Texas to a massive tropical storm that hit the Northeast, leaving millions of people without power. According to the Associated Press, the damage caused by severe storms this year has surpassed all the damage from extreme weather during the entire decade of the 1980s. Scientists attribute the extent of storm damage in 2011 to the growing impact of climate change and some bad luck. All told, 2011 witnessed over $52 billion worth of damages. In a recent speech, NOAA Administrator Jane Lubchenco called this year's extreme weather a harbinger of things to come, with more record heat waves, droughts, and big storms.
As the 17th Conference of the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change in Durban, South Africa, concluded on December 11th, many environmental activists were disappointed with the results, but relieved that the talks hadn't collapsed. With the 1997 Kyoto Protocol Treaty on Global Warming set to expire, the conference in Durban was tasked with negotiating an agreed-upon path toward developing a new international treaty that will control greenhouse gas emissions. Negotiators from the European Union in Durban argued for a legally binding treaty that would cover the entire world, including developing nations that had been exempt under Kyoto. The 11th-hour agreement hammered out in Durban pledged to work toward a new global treaty by 2015. But due to objections from India and China, the legal force of such an agreement remains ambiguous.
Negotiators in Durban also established a $100 billion green climate fund to assist poor nations in adapting to climate change and reduce their CO2 emissions. But the source of the money for the fund has not yet been settled. But while there was progress in some areas, leading scientists are alarmed that the conference in Durban failed to agree on any plan to dramatically cut emissions necessary to avoid the future destructive effects of global warming. Your reporter spoke with Daphne Wisham, co-director of the Institute for Policy Studies' Sustainable Energy and Economy Network. She summarizes the outcome of the UN Durban conference and the role the Obama administration played in the climate talks.
The Kyoto Protocol was destined to expire next year in 2012. What was agreed in Durban was that parties to the Kyoto Protocol would decide over the next year on whether or not to extend a second commitment period under the Kyoto Protocol. So that would essentially take us from 2013 till 2017. And it was agreed that they would take the next year on making that decision. So essentially what happened is that carbon markets got put on life support for another year, and perhaps at the end of next year they will continue until 2017. Next year, the conference of the parties will meet in the very undemocratic country of Qatar, and there are no commitments to emissions reductions from rich countries in the interim. Basically, what this means is that the Kyoto Protocol is on life support for the next year, and it's being potentially replaced by a new agreement that is even weaker unless we take action and make sure that that doesn't happen. The other thing that, you know, people are saying is a breakthrough is that all the parties agreed to legally binding emissions by 2020. We'll have to see how that plays out. Of course, China and India. China is now the number one greenhouse gas emitter. Their emissions have been rising quite dramatically over the last decade. And India's emissions are also beginning to head up in the uptick. But, you know, we have to keep in mind that these two countries have over 2 billion people combined and represent a significant share of the world's population, and they're just now beginning to come online. That doesn't mean they can't begin to develop in a way that avoids making the same mistakes that we have, but they still are experiencing quite significant levels of poverty. And, of course, we're exporting a lot of our coal from places like Wyoming, from the Powder River Basin, to China. So we're helping China and India burn lots and lots of coal, and we're culpable in their greenhouse gas emissions.
So if you were to assess the successes and failures of this Durban conference, so what would you say would be the highlights and lowlights there?
The highlights are that we saw people power in force, you know, that we saw youth in particular speaking out boldly at the climate negotiations, risking arrest, standing up for their future. It is, after all, the young people that are going to be paying the highest price around the world. We saw, you know, the beginnings of discussions that absolutely do need to take place between all of the countries globally, and, you know, as some of the small island states rightfully say to India and China, you want the right to develop, we want the right just to survive, and clearly survival trumps development. So we're beginning to have the discussion that's a fairly difficult one involving some of the larger emitting developing countries as well as the poorer ones, and that's at least a step in the right direction. The problem is that the U.S., once again, is not only not joining the Kyoto Protocol in any meaningful way, they've refused to put any money on the table. They refused to agree to any binding emissions cuts. They've even refused to support something called the financial transactions tax, which could potentially raise $600 billion a year while also curbing financial speculation, which is something that all of us are beginning to learn a lot more about in the aftermath of this meltdown we're living through, of, in part as a result of financial speculation. And on the one hand, the Obama administration has, to some degree, had its hands tied at the national level by the Senate, by the fact that we have a Senate that will not even consider climate legislation, and some senators who think that climate change doesn't even exist. So, you know, the Obama administration gets some sympathy on that level, but it gets no sympathy for actively trying to obstruct some of the talks that were going on at the international level, we kept hearing that Obama's negotiators were playing a negative role in obstructing progress at the international level, and that is absolutely shameful. Regardless of all of this climate science denial that's coming out of the U.S. and perhaps some other countries as well, the world passed the $1 trillion mark in clean energy investment since 2004. I think the future will be clean. It's just a question of how much damage we'll do in the interim, and hopefully, you know, people can take heart and know that people power really is making a difference in this country, and we've just got to keep it up.
That was Daphne Wisham, co-director of the Institute for Policy Studies Sustainable Energy and Economy Network. Find more analysis and commentary on the issue of climate change on our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org.